We got Dr. Charles Neville on saxophone.
From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Saxophonist Charles Neville, a founding member of the Neville Brothers, has died in Massachusetts at the age of 79. He'd been battling pancreatic cancer. In 2017, we spoke with Neville before his diagnosis was made public. We talked about his childhood, his earliest musical training, his travels, the addictions that led to a years-long prison sentence, Eastern religion, and his seminal role in the Grammy Award-winning band that inspired generations of musicians, including the Rolling Stones and the Grateful Dead.
You know, all of those experiences go into making me who I am.
The unmistakable Charles Neville, after the break. Charles Neville, the saxophonist and a founding father of the Neville Brothers, has died in Massachusetts. He was 79 years old and had been battling pancreatic cancer. When Neville was a child, he dreamed of adventure, and that's exactly what he got. As a young New Orleans-born saxophone player and flutist, he backed a raft of headliners whose names form a heavenly host of early rhythm and blues. Johnny Ace, Little Walter, Jimmy Reed, Big Maybelle, B.B. King. But that was just for starters. As the son of Big Arthur and Amelia Neville, he was an heir to the Wild Chapatoulas Mardi Gras Indian tradition. He was Dixie Cups adjacent. And over a musical career that spanned 60 years, Charles Neville headlined many of his own bands. Most recently, he toured with two of his sons in a group called the New England Nevilles. He also toured with his younger brother, Aaron Neville. We spoke with Charles Neville in New Orleans in 2017. Mr. Neville, what were you playing just now?
Oh, that was a tune that I wrote many years ago entitled In Her Image. That was dedicated to the half of the human population that was left out of the description of the Creator creating mankind in His image. So I was referring to those who were created in her image.
Thank you. So let me ask you this. I mean, you have been a musician for more than 60 years now. I mean, that's a fairly large chunk of life. And does it seem to you as if you've lived one life or more than one life?
Many more than one. You know, all of those experiences go into making me who I am. And that was cool. My brother Aaron wrote a song called To Make Me Who I Am, and it said, it took who I was and where I've been and what I've done to make me who I am.
Tell us more.
Well, the connection to the music started, you know, really early at home because everybody sang. You know, there were songs, my grandmother washing, cooking or something. There were songs that went with everything that was happening. At Bush Kindergarten Primary School, which was an all-black primary school and kindergarten, there was a rhythm band. There was music there. Where the music teacher played the piano, and she gave all of us little percussion instruments and taught us how to play rhythms along with what she was doing.
Do you still identify with that little kid, you know, in New Orleans growing up in the 40s?
It's like that part of me never left. And then, you know, in the black theaters as I was growing up, they would show the double feature, Roy Rogers.
It's a big world, Trigger. And like Bambi, a little fella like you has a lot to learn before he grows up. Sometimes it's fun, sometimes it's tough.
But in between, there would be what they called short subjects.
Yes.
And I remember seeing Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five. And I thought, whoa, man, he's having so much fun playing that horn, that saxophone. That's what I want to do. I want to play the saxophone.
If you've ever been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now, all through the week, you're quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night, they go from house to house. You don't have to pay to use an admission if you're a cook or a waiter or a good musician. So if you happen to be just passing by, stop in at the Saturday night fish fry. Caledonia! Caledonia! What make your big head so hard? I love her just the same. Great about that woman called Caledonia is her name.
That's amazing. I love Louis Jordan. I mean, who couldn't love Saturday Night Fish Fry, you know, or Caledonia, or...
Five Guys Named Mo.
That's right, Five Guys Named Mo.
I want to tell you a story from way back. Truck on down and dig me, Jack. There's Big Mo. Little Mo. Four-eyed Mo. No Mo. Look at brother. Look at brother. Look at brother. Who's the greatest band around? Makes the cats jump up and down. Who's the talk of Rhythm Town? Five Guys Named Mo.
You know, not long ago, I was talking to a man on the phone who had an office on Magazine Street, and he said, my office is near Valence. If you know Valence Street, you know the 13th Ward, and that's where the Neville Brothers come from. Do you understand? And I said, yes, I do. Yes, I do. And so as a family, you all were on Valence Street for a while, then you moved and you came back to Valence Street.
Right. I think I was like maybe 2.5 years old when we moved down to the Calio Project. And at that time, moving into the project was a move up.
Was it from Valence at that time?
Well, we were in a house where the bathroom was an outhouse in the back. There was no electricity. I remember vividly them lighting candles on the Christmas tree back then.
Uh-oh.
And cooking on, you know, wood stove and stuff. And then moving in the project where it was the gas stove and, you know, electric lights and the bathrooms, you know, and two floors of the house, you know, upstairs and downstairs. And back then everything was well kept. The yards where my grandmother planted a garden in the back where she was growing vegetables and stuff, and she had chickens.
Really?
Yeah.
Your father worked as a merchant marine, is that right?
Well, many things. He was a merchant marine. He and my uncle, George Landry, were both merchant marines. But also, he drove a truck for Bond Ford Motor Company. They had a place on Broad Street. He drove a cab for Ed's Cab Service, one of the black cab services in the city. He worked as a Pullman porter.
And, wow, on the trains.
Yeah.
And so, when you think about your childhood, was he there or was he not there?
He was in and out. He was there. But then there would be times when he'd be gone for a while and he'd come back with these great stories of the places he'd been and bring back really exotic little things. Like one of the things I remember, those sculptures made out of shells. One of the most popular ones was big sailing ships, but all made out of shells.
Did your mom work outside the house?
Yeah, she did.
Yeah?
She worked at Lane's Cotton Mill, which was at Chapultepec in Valence.
Oh, boy, Valence all the way at the river.
Chapultepec, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She also worked at a place I remember called the Blue Streak Laundry and, you know, other places.
Right.
And she was also a hairdresser.
This is a busy family.
Yeah.
And she raised six children.
Yes.
That's incredible. And you're the second? You're the second child? Yes. Wow. And so when you think about your house back then and all the people in it and all the activity in it, what did it sound like?
Well, you know, one of the good things was we didn't have a TV. And so when people came over to visit, the adults came over, they brought instruments or records. So the entertainment was music. And everybody in the family played something or sang.
And so is there any particular song, for instance, like if you hear it now or think about it now, it brings you right back to that home in the Calliope?
We live near Reverend Utah Smith's Two Wing Temple. And he had a song that was played on the radio called I Got Two Wings. And that was the theme in his church. They'd play that song. And I found a book about him many, many years later, and I didn't know he was known all over the world. And one of the things was he would come down the aisle in his church with his two wings, and he would fly. They said he'd come running down the aisle. The band would be playing that, I got two wings. And he'd come running down the aisle, and he'd leap up into there, and he had those wings that were like he would glide a little bit. So people in the church, he was flying.
At least I read, you loved getting your head into books. What kinds of books were you reading?
I was reading some of everything and anything. And the first one I remember, my father had a Western called Calamity Jane of Deadwood Gulch. And that was the first book without pictures that I read. It took me a while to get through it, but I really liked it. So first I started reading stuff that he had, the Westerns, and then I discovered Isaac Asimov and the sci-fi side. Whoa, that was some really cool stuff.
Really cool stuff.
So I started reading that and, philosophy, anything, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Read Shakespeare and...
I love that. But so then why would you leave school so early? You left school at 15.
Well, I wanted to play music, and I had an opportunity to go on the road with the band. And, my mother had told us the story of her and my Uncle Jolly they were dancers.
Landry and Landry.
Yeah, and they were gigging with Sam Butera was the saxophone player in that band.
Right, with Louis Prima.
Yeah. So they had been dancing with Louis Prima, so they had an offer to go with him on the road, and their parents wouldn't let him go.
Ah.
And so they were telling us that story back when we were really young. So if you guys ever get an opportunity like that, we won't stop you.
Is that right?
So when the time came for me to, for the guy came to see about, I told him I wanted to go on the road with the band. Man, you're still in high school, you're 50, you can't go out there with the band. I said, but remember what you told me about that if we ever got this opportunity, you wouldn't stop us, you'd let us go.
And so was this Gene Franklin or no?
Gene Franklin and his House Rockers.
And the House Rockers.
Yeah.
I just love that name.
And we used to rock the house.
Really? Well, yeah. What were you guys playing?
We were playing the blues and rhythm and blues stuff of the period. And, back then, black artists' faces weren't in the magazines and the newspapers and on TV, so nobody knew what some of the guys looked like. So sometimes Gene Franklin and his House Rockers would play a gig as B.B. King because we could play the song sound just like the record.
And so how did the headliners feel about knowing that there are other people out there performing under their name?
Well, they didn't know. But I was in Tampa, Florida with Gene Franklin and his House Rockers and saw a poster saying Aaron Neville and Ernie Cato playing at this place on Central Avenue. So I went over there in the afternoon and I see some guys I know from New Orleans. I said, hey, man, where Aaron and Cato? I said, oh, man, look, don't blow my thing. I'm Aaron tonight.
Singing over you, I say over you,
That's Aaron Neville on a 1960 release called Over You. Coming up, a song Charles Neville learned the hard way. Stay tuned. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Saxophonist Charles Neville has died at the age of 79. He'd been battling pancreatic cancer. In 2017, he told us about one of his earliest jobs in the 1950s, playing with Gene Franklin and the House Rockers. Ever been to Watts Anderson's Blue Room in Tampa?
That's where I first saw Iron Jaw.
Oh, boy, with a name like that. What did Iron Jaw do?
Well, first of all, he was a sword swallower.
Ooh.
He ate fire. He ate carpet tacks.
Oh, my word.
And remember those old green Coke bottles?
Yeah.
He would eat one like a chicken leg.
Come on. No.
And that was just, that was just the lightweight that he was doing. He was a tap dancer.
What?
Okay, he tap danced, and he had his assistant. He would put her in a chair, put the back of the chair in his teeth, and stand up and dance around with her in a chair in his teeth. Then after he did that for a while, he'd pick up the table, put the corner of the table in his mouth, and dance around with the table. Then he'd put the girl in the chair on the table and pick it up and dance around. Now, I was teaching a Tai Chi class at Jacob's Pillow Dance Academy up in Massachusetts in the mountains there, and I was telling some of the dance instructors about that, and they didn't believe it. That's impossible. Found an old Ed Sullivan Show DVD, and there was Iron Joe.
Really?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be a great commercial for, like, denture adhesives?
Yeah.
The things you can do with this denture adhesive.
And, you know, there were other acts like that.
So this is like a whole education for you as a young person. You know, sure, you left school at 15, but that was just the beginning of your education, wasn't it?
Right. I left that school and went to the big school. Yeah. Later, when I came off the road and decided to join the Navy in 56 to see the world, and, you know, when I finished boot camp and they gave us all the form to fill out to choose the station, where would you like to go for your permanent duty station? So I said, oh, boy, Tokyo, Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Nice.
San Diego, or a ship going anywhere. And they sent me to Memphis.
They sent you to Memphis.
And I thought, oh, no, back to the South. I was really bummed out until I found Beale Street. It was the Carbass Story, the Big 225, Joe Props, the Sunset Grill,
yeah.
Others. I can't remember all of those names now, but those ones that I worked at that I do remember.
Right. You met B.B. King there.
I had met B.B. King before that,
mm-hmm.
but then he was living in Memphis, so I got to hang out with him again and play with his band.
Yeah.
And what can I do? I just sing the blues. Well, I just sing the blues, 'cause that's the only thing I know to do.
One of the other people I met there and got to like him, he was really a cool guy, was Elvis Presley.
Really?
Really, he hung out on Beale Street. He was friends with B.B.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was like a musician, he was not the entertainer,
mm-hmm.
and he respected the cats.
When you were in the Navy, you spent both years, 2 years in Memphis?
Yeah, that was the only place I went.
Okay, and then you got out of the Navy as fast as you could.
Yeah.
Is that right? And so when you got out, what were your prospects?
By then, Larry mm-hmm. Williams had some hit records, and he was distantly related to us somehow. He was from Louisiana, hung out in New Orleans. Aaron had done some gigs with him.
Aaron Neville, uh-huh.
Yeah. And Art had done some gigs with him as well. And then I got in his band and started touring the South again, although we did go up north some.
A bad little kid moving to my neighborhood. He's a bad boy. He won't do nothing right. He's a poor.
chicks around the house and play that rock and roll music all night.
He's a bad boy.
He put thumbtacks in the teacher's chair, put chewing gum in the little girl's hair. Now, Junior, behave yourself.
Last summer when I got my time,
Angola bound.
Well, my ball, they got 100, I got 99,
Angola bound.
You've been a long time coming, but you're welcome home,
Angola bound.
Angola, Louisiana, get your burdens on,
Angola bound.
Tell us about the song Angola Bound. This is a song you co-wrote.
Yeah, that was something that everybody in New Orleans knew as little kids growing up, you know, about stories about Angola.
I mean, you went to Angola State Penitentiary in the 1963, 1964, something like that.
And then in there, the old guys would sing, "You've been a long time coming, but you're welcome home. Down here in Angola, Louisiana, is the murderer's home." And all the other little stories in it. Aaron took some of the lines, "Everybody talking about old Dangerous Blue, but if I had my pistol, I'd be dangerous too." And the other one, "Oh, you come here buck jumping, but you won't last long. Down here in Angola, Louisiana, gonna make you wish you was a baby in your mother's arm. And if you see my mother, tell her this for me. Got a long, long time, might never go free." He sang it pretty much the same way, you know, similar to the way I was singing it, but just, added the music and the funky rhythm.
Now, the thing is, you ended up there for a very weird reason.
For possession of 2 marijuana cigarettes, 2
yes.
joints. Got 5 years at hard labor for possession of 2 marijuana. But the charge read possession of narcotics. There was no distinction between
pot
and other drugs. It was just narcotics.
That's insane. That's insane.
But that's the way it was back then.
You went in a good musician. You came out a much better musician. How often does that happen?
Well, once I got the job working in the music department, where I didn't have to go out in the field all day, I stayed in the music room practicing all day. And that was it. That and the fact that we could write to Tulane or to any university and they would send us books. So we had all kinds of theory books and the time to really work on it. And there were other great musicians there. James Booker was there for a little while when I got there.
Yeah.
And then James Black came in after
the great
I was
drummer.
There. Yeah.
So you didn't overlap with him, James Black?
Yeah, he
you
was
did?
There. Yeah, he came in while I was there. And he had been on the road with Yusef Lateef.
That's right.
So he come in there with that Assalamu Alaikum. Ready to tell the wife, oh, don't play that.
Not Muslim friendly in the 60s. No. Wow.
And so he was out in the field, so we were trying to get him get him out of the field, get him into the education building. So the first job we could get him was teaching English in the English class before we could get him in the music room.
Yeah.
And one day after he was in the music room for a while, he leaves out to go to the bathroom, and I hear him hollering out in the hall, "Charles Neville! Charles Neville!" I look out the door. The captain got him up against the wall with his hands up on the wall. I said, "Oh, what happened?"
What?
So I go out there. I say, "Cap, what happened?" He said, "I caught this old in the white bathroom." You know what he told me when I asked, "What you doing in the white bathroom?" He said, "I'm taking a shit."
So honesty really is the best policy.
So they were gonna, put him in the dungeon for being smart. By telling the man that when the man asked him, "What are you doing in there?"
Is the dungeon solitary?
Oh, it's more than that.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. And so, in the dungeon, the people I know who went to the dungeon said, it was 6 o'clock in the morning. You got a thin slice of bread with a teaspoon full of greens and a cup of water. 6 o'clock in the evening, you get a thin slice of bread with a teaspoon full of beans and a cup of water. Plus, you get beat up.
Oh, that's no good. That's no good.
But, anyway, I had to tell the man, you know, oh, Captain, look, boss, he just got here. He don't know. He had to let me take him and see if I can, you know, help get him right, you know, get him to know how to act right. So Jam told me the reason he went in. They said he went in the black bathroom. The guy was getting raped in there, so he left. Say he didn't want me no part of that.
Boy, do you think that you would have gotten you would have gotten your sentence whether you had a great representation or not? Meaning, is there any way that through the courts you could have avoided actually serving this sentence?
No.
At that time?
No. I got busted for weed, but at the time I was a drug addict. I had been doing other drugs, doing other kind of crimes and shit, you know, so no, I couldn't have. Maybe Johnny Cochran.
Maybe Johnny Cochran.
If it wasn't for the captain, oh Lord, I'm shaggy hound, I'd be with my woman, yeah, before the sun goes down. They come up here skipping and jumping, oh Lord, it won't last long. Gonna wish it was a baby boy, then their mother was gone.
When you listen to Angola Bound, where does that put you emotionally when you hear that song?
Well, now it's just a song commemorating those days and kind of allows us to think about the many friends we have who are still up there and some who have been there for a very long time. And especially the young kids going up there who have no idea what they're going into.
By the late 60s, you had moved to New York and you were playing professionally. And so were you yearning to have a Charles Neville ensemble in New York?
No.
No?
I was just playing music.
Why? So many musicians, they say, I want my contribution to be out there. I want my name to be out there. I want to be the headliner.
No, people ask me about all the recording years in New Orleans, and I wasn't involved in recording because, to me, making the music was something that was happening at the time it happened. And it didn't matter to me that it was recorded and that somebody could hear it again later because the people it was being shared with at the time, that was the reality of the music. And that was why I played mainly for that purpose. I wasn't thinking about, you know, becoming famous.
But it didn't take long for Charles Neville to become famous. Coming up, liberty, equality, and fraternity. Neville style. Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. We're talking about saxophonist Charles Neville, who died this week at the age of 79. Neville lived an extraordinary life. In the 1970s, he was in New York City and had no plans to return to New Orleans. But when his uncle set a family recording date back home, Charles made the trip. Uncle George Landry was Big Chief Jolly of the Wild Chapatulas, and their 1976 self-titled album made history.
Here John, here he come.
Chief Jolly convinced his nephews that their destiny was to work together. So they did. And that's how Art, Charles, Aaron, and Cyril Neville came to perform as the Neville brothers. Each brought his own experience to the family act. Doo-wop, soul, R&B, funk, Latin music, gospel, bebop. And that combination made for a string of critically acclaimed albums and magnificent live performances well into the 21st century.
Mona Lisa, Manhattan Angel, oh, select lady with a mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile?
The Neville Brothers traveled the world on tour with the Rolling Stones and the Grateful Dead. But along with the music and the acclaim, drug addiction was a major theme of their story. Charles had been trying and failing to get off hard drugs since his earliest days in New York.
I'd gotten on the methadone, which was much worse than heroin.
How is methadone worse than heroin?
For it to get out of your system, the heroin takes from 3 days to 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay.
Your body goes into this breakdown and you get really sick. The withdrawal symptoms from the methadone is much worse than the withdrawal symptoms from the heroin and lasts much longer. So that's like from 3 weeks to 6 months.
Come on.
Of being sick. Yeah, so it's much worse. A lot of us who were on methadone would get off the methadone and then be sick for so long, we get back on the heroin to keep from being sick until that got so bad that we had to start robbing and stealing, so then get back on the methadone to, you know, just round and round that cycle. Until finally I went to Eugene, Oregon, to a center there called Serenity Lane, and that place was where all of the people connected with the program were recovering from something, from the doctor who ran the place to the, you know, everybody involved with it. So it was a really good program, and I was in it, the live-in program, for like 60 days. And then I was in the aftercare program for a year after that, where I was still, I didn't have to live there, but I would have to go every day.
And so around what time was this?
This was 86. That was when I finally got off of everything, was 86.
Good for you. I mean, really, I know it sounds silly for me to say that, but I mean, that is a huge achievement. And it's, you know, it's funny because it's not something that you necessarily would write on your resume, but it's bigger than anything that you would write on your resume.
There were a lot of people who were caught in that trap who never got out. Well, they got out, but by dying.
Right, right. You're talking about 1986 as like a freedom year for you. And all, and if the Neville Brothers began in 76, and you spent 10 years with the Neville Brothers performing and all that, with this part of your life, you know what I mean, still unresolved.
Right, because I was still on the methadone. We would travel, and I would have a card to take to find the methadone program or whatever town we were in to go there and get some medicine.
Mm-hmm. And so it's like it's a part-time job.
Yeah, yeah. And then depending on where the clinic is, and we went to London where they go to the clinic, didn't have methadone, they had pharmaceutical heroin.
Oh, man. But in terms of your recording career with the Neville Brothers, did you ever find it difficult to translate the power of the live performance to record?
When we recorded, we just played. It was like the live performance, and they were just recording it.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's that thing, that connection to that higher energy where everything comes from, that makes it happen. Like one of the things when we were doing the Yellow Moon album, there was a track that had been laid down for a song, for a vocal, and they never did get the lyrics together. So the producer said, well, let's make it an instrumental. And since it had a really swampy kind of funky feel, and he said, oh, well, let's put something to it. So I said, okay, let me see what to do. So they played the rhythm, and I just started playing. And so after I went through, I said, okay, let's take one. He said, we got it. That was it. I said,
wow.
But I wasn't even thinking. I was just listening to it and letting it take me. He said, well, that was it. And that was the one that won the Grammy.
Exactly. That's the one that won the Grammy.
Healing Chant.
Have like this very interesting and smooth energy that's very rich, you know? And so if I were to say, what does Charles Neville bring to the Neville Brothers? I would say that in many ways you bring a cerebral spirit to the Neville Brothers.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I feel also like a centering energy, a calming and centering energy.
Yes. And I think it's in part because you're not competitive. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, a lot of brothers compete with one another, you know, but you are sort of an oasis, I think, within that outfit.
Yeah.
You know? And once I saw you all perform, and it's in a film called Lightning in a Bottle. I don't know if you remember that concert.
Yeah.
It was at Radio City Music Hall, some about more a little bit more than 10 years ago, and it was a tribute to the blues. And you all come out and you sing Big Chief, right? And it stole the evening. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was that exciting. And there's a shot of you from behind, and you're playing cowbell, I think it is, mm-hmm. and you look over at your brother. And the way you looked at him and smiled, it was as if you were saying, at least to me, isn't this extraordinary that we're living in this moment together, you know? And I've never forgotten that glance and that smile because, you know, without it, I don't know if the Neville Brothers could have made it as far as you all did, you know?
Well, you know, the thing about that, though, is that looking over at art, the connection was happening.
Yes.
That it's there. We're in the same spaceship.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're in the same spaceship.
We got five people that I don't know about. If my water's gonna make me sound, I'm going down to get my queen.
About the Neville Brothers is that you sold a lot of records, you were on every show imaginable on television, you performed with many of the biggest acts in rock and roll, and yet there seemed to be some type of barrier to you and greater success. What do you think that barrier was?
The difficulty in categorizing what we do and in pigeonholing it and deciding, oh, this is this, because we've gone into record stores where our stuff was in the country music section.
No way.
Yeah, yeah, they didn't, you know, and that's why I didn't get played on radio, because the program directors didn't know, well, what is this?
Right.
You know?
Do you feel as if there's another iteration for the Neville brothers themselves, or no?
No, like, you know, Aaron has his band, is doing his thing separately, which he wanted to do for a long time, and now he's got the chance. Cyril has been doing his own thing, and Art's got the Meters and the Funky Meters, but we did this show called A Neville Family Function with everybody except Aaron. Aaron wasn't there, but it was me, Cyril, Art, Ivan, Ian, Jason, Aaron Jr., and some other cats who have played with the Neville Brothers band over the years. So, yeah, that was really, really special and really good, and we're hoping to do that again.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, starting in 2017 and hopefully going into the future.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that in all the acts that you've described among your brothers, you know, Aaron Neville as a solo artist, Art Neville, you know, I mean, with the Funky Meters, and, you know, and Cyril Neville with his own organizations, you mean, you have supported almost all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, they always want you. They may not want each other, but they always want you.
Well, the horn, the sound of the horn. The sound of the saxophone is close to the sound of a human voice. You know, like there were guys with the trumpet who used to play, and you could make the trumpet talk. You know,
yeah.
Say, wah, 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 and make words. The same with the saxophone, you know. It can sing.
Can you show us? It's a beautiful blues. There's always like a tenderness in your tone.
The sound of the tenor is feminine and masculine, and there's a spirit in it that is expressed in the sound, so that it's the person's playing it spirit and the spirit of the horn combining to make whatever comes out of it.
I love that. And I love the breathiness sometimes in your music and your tone. It feels as if there's a life force coming out of that.
Right, that's exactly how I think of that part too, is that's the life of the sound.
Even when you were with the Neville brothers, didn't you have the Charles Neville and Diversity group?
Well, yeah, I had that group all along. Like, when I first moved back to New Orleans, I put together a band. And with the Diversity, I was working with some of the members of the New Orleans Symphony Orchestra. And that's why we called it Diversity, because of what we were doing. I had the opportunity to record with that band.
And so was Johnny Vidakovich part of that?
Yeah, he was.
The great drummer?
Yeah. And then later, Jim Laston plays bassoon. And we had a band together that we recorded a CD called Safe in Buddha's Palm.
Yes. It's a beautiful title. Where does it come from?
Well, there's all the different images of the Buddha. And there was one Buddha called the Medicine Buddha. And he's sitting there and he's holding a little vessel in his hand. It said that vessel contains the medicine for the ills of the world. And so we got permission, the girl who actually did that drawing got permission from the Dalai Lama to use that image on a commercial thing. And I did the painting of the face and she did the drawing of the Buddha. And instead of that vessel, we put an image of the earth in his palm and said, so the earth is safe in Buddha's palm. So we all are safe in Buddha's palm.
Well, there came a point when you actually left New Orleans again, and I would probably venture that you left it for good. When you moved up to Massachusetts, what happened?
Oh, well, I met this girl from Massachusetts, and we got together, and after a few years, we got married. And when we got married, her parents gave us some land as a wedding gift, so we built a house up there in the woods.
Oh, wow. That's everybody's dream.
Yeah.
House up there, anywhere in the woods. But my understanding is that you've got a yurt up there.
Yeah. I had the yurt built where I was doing my music lessons. And also I had my, did my meditation in there. And
but now you've got a family up there. You've got sons who are playing with you. The New England Nevilles.
Yes. The New England Nevilles with Khalif Neville playing keyboards, Talon Neville playing drums, and Mark Brooks playing bass.
So, I mean, that's a wonderful thing in the sense that just as you wanted to travel like your dad and see the world, they see something in their dad that they want to share in as well, you know?
Yeah, and it's really great to get to play with them.
Exactly. And so does Charmaine Neville ever come up north to play with you all?
She does. In fact, my wife has been producing a jazz festival up in Springfield, Massachusetts, and she brought Charmaine up for that festival.
That's excellent.
So we all got to play with Charmaine there.
You've lived many lives in the years that you have been a musician playing music around the world. What life are you in now?
I don't know where this is the New England life. The environment that I live in up there is so cool. When we first moved up there, I remember being told by someone, if you see 5 cars on this road in the course of a day, that's heavy traffic. We're in the woods, you know, we see deer, we see a moose every now and then. We hear the coyotes around. We see a bear every now and then. And the ones who come up to the door, there's a porcupine. For a while, across the road from us, the guy had cows who would get out and come over and eat the stuff in our garden.
It sounds like a beautiful life. Wow. Is that Huntington?
That's Huntington. But then we're not too far from the big city of Northampton.
But so are you painting up there?
I'm just doing pencil drawing now. Mm-hmm. Just for fun, you know.
I wonder if one day you'll actually put together a book of your drawings and, you know, I mean, your artwork or something that reflects your life there. Because it would be interesting to people to look through your eyes and understand your perspective on things. I think that, you know, you might actually serve the same role to your readers as you did in the Neville Brothers, as the philosopher who reminds people to live in the moment, to understand the beauty of the moment and to share that moment with someone else.
Yeah, maybe that's part of my purpose. for being here.
Well, Charles Neville, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right, you're welcome. I'm very happy to have been able to do this.
What would you like to go out on? Anything in particular?
Well, you know, something that the Dalai Lama said about religion. He said, loving kindness is my religion.
We're saying goodbye to Charles Neville, who died this week at the age of 79. Our show was produced by Lynette Johnson, Garrett Pittman, and Jason Rhine. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a complete playlist of the songs in this hour, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Rosa Mary Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax-deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.